Welcome to the Doorkeepers Book Club. I'm your host, Lily Dureis, and today in this episode, I will begin by taking a short meta moment to explain why I feel the need to do this podcast and what I hope to accomplish with it before jumping into my feelings about Mormonism, especially on this day, today, September 21st, 2019, where I have just resigned from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But to start off, I feel the need to do a podcast because in the course of leaving Mormonism, there are so many feelings and thoughts that I have to process. Pain and anger and grief and rage, as well as excitement and liberation and a newfound sense of ownership over my own life. And so these are all things that I need a place to verbally explore. I also hope to come to a place where I can see the world through kinder eyes. And by that I mean, when I was a Mormon, I brought to every relationship a sense of missionary purpose, because I felt that I had the truth, the absolute truth, and was a part of the one true church. And therefore, every family relationship, every friendship that I had this sense of duty to be an example, to share what I knew, and to be a source of truth for whoever I was interacting with in my life. And looking back on that, I feel that that missionary attitude was in actuality a pride, a sense of otherness, a sense of religious superiority. And what's ironic is that in leaving Mormonism, I have carried this attitude with me, but reversed it. So now, when I encounter religious orthodoxy, and in particular, Mormon orthodoxy, I feel the same sense of duty and need to share and enlighten that I did when I was Mormon. And I don't think this is healthy. So my hope is that through interviewing the people that I love who make different choices than I do, including the Orthodox Mormons in my life, that I can practice listening and respecting and trying to see the world through their eyes, because that mindset is one that I used to have. And even though I feel allergic to it, I want to be able to accept it, because the fact is, this world is full of so many different viewpoints, and Orthodox religion has a place in today's world, and there are people who view the world through this lens. And in order to come to peace with that, I feel that I need a space to practice listening and respecting that. And I hope that by doing this in a semi-public place, such as a podcast, that this exercise can perhaps be of some help to some other people who might be struggling through these same feelings and the same sort of self-rehabilitation that I feel that I need to do. So to start off with, I want to give an overview of my own journey in and through and out of Mormonism. And in order to do that, I'm going to have to rewind to before I was born and share a little bit about my parents, because I was born into a mixed faith household, and both of my parents approached religion, and in particular Mormonism, with a very charged and certain attitudes. And those attitudes had um, had a had roots in their own personal histories. So I'll take a minute to first start by telling you a bit about my dad. My dad, Benjamin Lamson, was born in 1928 on a leper colony in the Philippines. His parents were hospital workers there, but he grew up in a lot of poverty and abuse. His mom died when he was 11 months old, and therefore he was raised by a stepmother and a father who were so harsh to him that at the age of 10, he actually ran away. And by run away, I mean he boarded boats, he went on foot, and he made his way to his grandparents. If I understand correctly, they lived in Manila, which was hundreds of miles from his little island of Culion. I think that speaks to my dad's determination and also the depth of trauma he was experiencing in his home. And his resilience and resourcefulness, and also the charisma that he had. And when he was a teenager, the Japanese invaded the Philippines, and he endured that trauma as well, of seeing his countrymen publicly tortured and executed. And occasionally, as I was growing up, he would relate these stories to us. When he was in his 20s, he immigrated to the United States with the Jesuits. He was a Jesuit at the time. He ended up leaving the Jesuits and becoming a professor of philosophy over here. And when he had me in his 50s, I was the first child of his second marriage. And he had lived in the States for many years, had traveled the world. He spoke 8 languages. He was a professor of philosophy, like I said, so he was well acquainted with Christian theology, especially Catholic theology, and was a very smart and resourceful person. When he met my mom, who was Mormon at the time, he assumed that Mormonism was some sort of esoteric branch of Protestantism. But shortly after they got married, it quickly became clear to him that this religion was not what he had assumed, that it affected every aspect of my mom's life, and he felt that it was an intrusive kind of third person in their marriage, and he came to resent it greatly. He researched it thoroughly. He had a library of Mormon history in our house. He was well acquainted with the work of the Tanners that they did, and stayed on top of Mormonism in the news, and just knew a lot about the subject historically, and of course, from the perspective of a Catholic philosopher, he had very definite views on the religion and felt that it was damaging and unhealthy. So that's where he was coming from. And he brought a lot of energy and emotion to his perspective on Mormonism. And in my opinion, all of the trauma that he experienced in his life up until the point that he met my mom and started a family with her, he directed all of his frustration and rage for the things that he personally had experienced to the Mormon church, such that in our household growing up, everything seemed to resolve around Mormonism. We walked on eggshells because if my brother spilled a glass of water or if we did anything wrong that was as far as unrelated as you could possibly imagine to religion, somehow my dad would tie it back to the way Mormonism was destroying our family. So he felt very, very resentful and had a lot of pent-up frustration, rage, and anger that he continually expressed at the Mormon church growing up. Backing up, I will tell you where my mom came from in her approach to religion. So my mom was raised Catholic in Springfield, Illinois. She was a very bright and high achiever and ended up at Stanford in the 60s quite by accident. In fact, she didn't realize what Stanford was till she was standing in line and at the registration or whatever, and the girls behind her, the women, were talking about how hard it was to get in. And it started to dawn on her that this was perhaps not just a normal school. And her experience at Stanford was incredibly traumatic. The professors in the 60s were actively preaching that God was dead. And in the course of attending college there, she had an existential crisis and lost all faith in the Catholic Church and was not sure if God existed at all. And she continually describes this period of her life as dark, lost, and confused. And she also, I think, struggled at Stanford to feel worthy, to feel like she had a place there, and she just struggled with feeling different. She came from a small town in Illinois, and everyone around her seemed very cultured and educated, and it was just a very difficult adjustment for her. She got married when she was at Stanford, and they ended up moving to Chicago, where she and her husband both got MBAs at the University of Chicago. And during the course of that time, if my timeline is correct, that's when she and her first husband divorced. And after the divorce, she enrolled in law school. And in the course of that, she was under extreme stress. She was in a state of deep depression from the divorce. She was working full time and going to law school and exercising a lot and barely sleeping. And it was just a time of extreme pain for her. And when she talks about that period of her life, she says that she didn't even know how people could smile. She didn't understand why people would ever be happy. And so she started exploring spirituality as a possible solution to her depression and checked out many books from the library, yoga books, and talked to a Catholic priest to see what it would be like to go back to the Catholic Church. And in the course of these explorations, she would send these great big prayers to her ex-husband while she did yoga to try to send some healing in his direction. And one day he called her and basically tentatively suggested that there might be one true church on the earth and asked if he could send her missionaries. And my mom at that point was extremely open to anything in terms of spirituality. So she, of course, agreed. The missionaries came and her spirit recognized the Book of Mormon as truth. Within 2 weeks, she was baptized and her life was filled with joy and purpose and she felt new meaning. And the church brought her a sense of just great joy in her life that she had not experienced to that point. And she had many spiritual experiences that were very sacred to her, miracles even to her, that confirmed to her that this church was true, absolutely true, and the one and only true and living church on the face of the earth. By that time, she was 35, and she met my dad when she was 38, so 3 years later, and she had one of her spiritual experiences upon meeting him, wherein she was able to picture him in the temple with her and felt that it was just a matter of time until he became Mormon. So they were married very quickly, within a matter of months, both of them thinking that they could change the other person's opinion on religion. And then when it quickly became clear that neither of them would change, this became a source of continual contention. And my mom is a very sweet, kind, soft-spoken person. Even though she was a lawyer, she practiced corporate law. She did not like litigation. She does not like conflict of really any kind. And so when I say contention, it was really just my dad screaming and blowing up in the house over Mormonism. And my mom would be crying and feeling very scared. There was abuse in the relationship as well. Before I was born, my dad pushed my mom around. He tried to physically force wine down her throat. And I'm not sure exactly all the details, but at one point during her pregnancy with my mom gave my dad an ultimatum and said that she would most certainly leave if the physical abuse continued. And miraculously, the physical abuse stopped. Now, I don't know how that happened because it seems like in the case of physical abusers, they are unable to make a change. But my dad had tremendous willpower when he decided to exert it. And I think he could see my mom was serious. And at the end of the day, he was very in love with her as she was with him. And he was motivated to stop that that particular strain of abuse. However, the emotional abuse was continual and honestly defined my entire childhood. I grew up with feeling in my home that I was never safe because at any point, seemingly random things could throw my dad into a rage. Occasionally blood would trickle down his ear. I remember on one occasion when he was yelling so hard, he foamed at the mouth. And he would just say really horrible, scary things. And while he was raging on and on about the Mormons. So Mormon was the first word that I learned to spell because my dad was talking about it so often. And I was basically born into a very religiously explosive environment. So my parents could not agree on what religion to raise us. My mom did not want us to be raised Catholic because she had negative feelings about Catholicism. Especially at that time, it was the height of kind of anti-Catholic fervor in the church. Bruce R. McConkie was, I think, had published at some point in Mormon Doctrine that the Catholic Church was the church of the devil or something to that effect. And so she didn't feel comfortable raising us in Catholicism. And certainly my dad did not feel comfortable raising us as Mormons. In fact, when my mom tried to take me to church several weeks after she gave birth to me, she said she feared for my life because he pulled the baby carrier out of her hands and she was afraid he would actually turn it upside down and dump me out if she tried to pull it back. So basically she feared that that it was just not physically safe to take me to church. And so they went to a counselor, and as a compromise, they worked out that my younger brother and I could be raised Presbyterian, which was my mom's dad's religion, and that when we were old enough, we could choose our own religion. So because religion was such, was really the defining issue in my household that our family world revolved around from a young age. My mom tells me I was around the age of 5 when this started. I began to ask my mom at night religious questions about where I came from and what would happen after we die. And I would ask her about her church because my dad hated it so much. And so we started this sort of tradition between ourselves where every night when she tucked me in, I would whisper these questions to her and my mom would whisper her answers because she was not allowed to speak openly of her religion in the home. My dad was allowed to rage about it, but my mom was not allowed to talk about it. So we would have these secret conversations. And so what happened was that I grew up feeling like I was internally Mormon, even though I was a practicing Protestant Christian. And I loved the Presbyterian church where I was raised. There was nothing wrong with it. The people were wonderful. It was a place where I felt safe. It was a place where my parents actually came together to worship together, which was so incredible. My mom would go to her Mormon church in the morning for 3 hours. My dad would tote us to Sunday school, and he was very active in the Presbyterian church. And then in the evening, we would go to church again as a family and worship in the contemporary worship service in the evening. And I loved that. And I think a lot of that affection I had for the Presbyterian church was because it was a neutral space where I felt safe and happy and close to God and not threatened. But I also felt duplicitous because my internal schema felt very Mormon. I knew about the preexistence and I believed in the preexistence. I mean, by the time I reached middle school, from these daily conversations with my mom, I had a very thorough education in Mormonism. I believed it all, accepted it all. And when I was 11, I read the Book of Mormon in a crack between my bed and the wall, just in case my dad were ever to walk in, and felt that it was true, that my mom's church was the true church, and that I felt like I was living a lie. Like, you know, there's nothing wrong with being Presbyterian, but I didn't feel it aligned with my internal paradigm. And that felt duplicitous and false of me. So I wanted to live the truths that I internally espoused. And when I turned 12, I asked my dad if I could start attending the Mormon church. And this was an incredibly scary thing for me to do because Mormonism was the topic that set my dad off, and I couldn't imagine what would happen when he found out that I actually wanted to practice Mormonism and to attend church. And it was indeed a very ugly day in our household. But I think my dad was so shocked and taken aback that ultimately he relented and allowed me to start going to church with my mom. And so at the age of 12, I changed churches and started attending our local LDS ward. And the initial change to Mormonism was a shock to me. It was a completely new culture. Even though the concepts were very familiar, the theology I accepted, but the culture just was quite different than the Presbyterian church, right down to the building, which I considered ugly, compared to the beautiful stained glass and sanctuary at the Presbyterian church. But those are minor details, and the social difficulties that I had at that age. I was very socially awkward and very shy, and so it was hard for me to make friends, even to have the courage to open my mouth or talk. but all of those difficulties and the culture shock and the ugly building, which in retrospect was actually pretty compared to most LDS chapels, it was actually somewhat thoughtfully designed, or at least a little bit artistic compared to the cookie cutter chapels that I've attended elsewhere. At any rate, all of those difficulties, I felt like it was worth surmounting. They were minor, especially in comparison to the feeling of relief, immense relief, at being able to align my outward religious practice with the way I felt about religion on the inside. And eventually my decision to join the church led to my parents' divorce. 4 years later, after I went on my first overnight trip with the youth in my ward, I came home and found my dad sitting at the table in a rage. He also struggled with alcoholism my entire childhood, so I believe he was quite drunk when I came home that day, and he announced that the marriage was over, that he would be leaving the family because he could not handle living with two Mormons in the home. And after that explosion, we all went upstairs. My mom came into my room and we were reading Deuteronomy together, and there's a section in Deuteronomy that talks about not making marriages with people outside of the religion because your children will go astray. And at that point, my mom felt a confirmation from the Spirit that she needed to divorce my dad, and followed through with that. Even though my dad the next day said that he was sorry and he wanted to try again, by that point my mom felt like she had a spiritual confirmation that the marriage was over, and they divorced. And after they divorced, I was free to get baptized. So I did. At the age of 16, I got baptized. And there's so much going on there, like from my mom's perspective, from my dad's perspective, but I will talk from my perspective as a 16-year-old, for the first time being able to talk about religion freely in the home, to practice my religion without fear of any like sort of repercussion, to read my scriptures openly, to talk about Mormonism openly. I felt so much joy. And I know that sounds crazy because my parents had just divorced, but perhaps like this has given some sketch of how troubled and complicated the family life was before that divorce, that honestly, my life as a child in that home after the divorce felt very happy and joyful and free. And I remember walking to school in the sunshine, feeling like Jesus was right next to me, and just so happy to live my religion openly. I felt like I could breathe, and I hadn't been able to breathe my whole life, but it was just a lot of joy at that time. And religion, you know, was my world. It always had been. It had been a topic of contention since before I was born. And finally, to be free to live my religion was like a soaring experience for me. And I threw myself into religion and was very Orthodox. I had a lot of missionary zeal. When I went to college, I spent a lot of my free time going on splits with the missionaries and bringing my Book of Mormon everywhere openly. I'd read it in the hallways before class. I gave it to professors. I worked at the information desk in the library and I'd read it there, hoping that people would come and like stumble on the scriptures or ask me questions so I could be a missionary to them. And then I ended up getting endowed early at the age of 19. I felt spiritually impressed that that was something that I needed to do. And so I took out my endowment when I was 19 and had like what I consider to be a very confirming experience in the temple, because my new name, which again, I said this would not be a safe podcast for Orthodox members, but I am going to say it because I obviously no longer believe it, that the temple like has any sort of eternal repercussions for me personally. But the new name that I was given in the temple was Lydia. And Lydia was a very meaningful name to me, because it's the name of my deceased aunt, my dad's sister, who had mothered him as a child. And she was kind of like a family saint growing up. And Lily was her nickname. And my name is Lily. I'm named after her. And so I always felt very close to her spiritually. And to be given that name in the temple meant to me that that she was approving, that she was there. And the temple worker who told me my new name, when I think she saw the look of shock in my face, just kind of smiled knowingly, like she knew that this would be special to me. One more thing about that name, I actually used to sign my papers Lydia in elementary school because I felt that that was my true identity. And I signed my third grade papers so often that my teacher started calling me Lydia, at which point I thought I'd overdone it. And so I started signing my papers Lily again. But just to give a sense, like that was a very powerful experience for me and confirmed in my mind that not only was this the one true church, but that the temple was true and everything that went on there was of eternal relevance to me, and that my ancestors were involved. So I had that experience. I went on a bunch of different study abroads after that and had many experiences on my study abroads that felt very guided and where I felt very spiritually on fire and alive. And honestly, during this period of my life, I don't recall having any questions about whether the church was true or not. I don't even think I had a shelf or would know what you were talking about if you were trying to explain to me the concept of a metaphorical shelf. In Mormonism, we call like questions that we have about the faith, like we often counsel each other to put those doubts and questions on a shelf. But I don't even think at that period in my life I had doubts or questions to put on a shelf. I was very, very faithful and very believing and very strict in my observance of the religion. When I returned home from my study abroad, my dad had a stroke, and unbeknownst to me, he had made me his power of attorney over his health and also of everything. So I ended up quitting college to go and live with him and try my best to care for him before he died. And this was very significant because when I got baptized, my dad cut off contact with me for many years. I don't know, at least two, perhaps more than two. I don't exactly remember when he reached out or I reached out. But after several years, one of us reached out to the other and we had a really healing experience of reconciliation. And this was before my dad got sick and before my study abroad. I actually flew out to his home in California. And at the end of that visit, as I was waiting for my shuttle to bring me to the airport, I turned to my dad and said, "Dad, I feel like because I am a Mormon, you don't love me and you're not proud of me." And my dad, who is never overtly affectionate, in fact, I don't recall receiving any verbal or physical affection, really. Maybe like two times before then as a child, but not since I had joined the church. My dad took me in his arms and told me that in spite of the fact that I was Mormon, I would always be his daughter and that he would always love me. So I think that experience was very powerful for both of us, and that's probably why he made those new conditions or gave me power of attorney or whatever and made it so that I flew out to be with him before he died. And honestly, that time in my life was very dark and painful and confused. And I was 20 and just felt really out of my element caring for my father, who was sick and mentally not quite there. So it was just a very painful time, and it ended up with him passing. And after he died, I went back to school, finished school, and then served a mission on Temple Square. Before I served my mission, I did the temple work for my dad and had an experience that felt very moving to me in the temple. I felt like my dad was there. I felt spiritual confirmations that he had accepted the church after death and was now, through this temple work, a Mormon. That is what I felt at the time. And so I went on my mission feeling like, you know, both of my parents in one way or the other were Mormons, and I felt I still so much missionary zeal and surety about my religion. And my mission was overall a very joyful experience. I served on Temple Square, so I met a lot of wonderful, smart women from all around the world and just made a lot of friends. And it wasn't, there were periods of struggle, but I would say the overall theme was just joy and happiness. One relevant part of my mission, though, that would come into play later in the faith journey is that, or I guess two relevant pieces. Temple Square missionaries, when I served a mission between 2005 and 2007, gave tours of the Beehive House to tourists. And as part of our Beehive House tour script, we were instructed at the beginning of the script to get a testimony of polygamy, because the Beehive House is where Brigham Young practiced polygamy. And as an abstract concept, I had no problem with polygamy. Like I said, I had no shelf, no doubts, no questions about the church. So I dutifully went, got my testimony of polygamy, and had zero problems giving tours of the Beehive House and bearing my testimony that polygamy was of God, it was for a specific purpose, and I could easily explain those purposes, and had no problem with this part of church history. And I was well aware Joseph Smith practiced polygamy. My dad had screamed about it since the time I was young, and I had no problem with that. Another part of the Temple Square Mission was giving tours of the Humanitarian Center, which I served at least two transfers in the Humanitarian Center, maybe three. It was my favorite place to serve as a Temple Square missionary. But I did notice as I was giving tours of the Humanitarian Center that the humanitarian aid structure of the church did seem a little inefficient. Like, I noticed that the church had partnered with a lot of different humanitarian organizations. So if you give money to the church, for a lot of that money, they will like then give to their charitable partners, like the Red Cross or Catholic Charities or whatever, because those charities are already set up on the ground and the church can just kind of fund them. But the one concern that people normally have when giving to a humanitarian fund is the like paying for the bureaucratic costs, which are necessary. But I mean, I think most people want to keep those as low as possible. At any rate, when you give to LDS charities, you pay for two different bureaucracies. And I did notice that that was kind of an inefficient way to give. But again, no shelf, no questions. It seemed really irrelevant to the truthfulness of the church, and honestly, kind of still is in some ways. So that was as close to a question as I ever had on my mission, like why the church was so inefficient in its humanitarian work. But other than that, no shelf, no questions. Then after my mission, I went to grad school, and I think grad school is where a lot of my problems began. So I went to study, I got a master's in education at Harvard, and the Harvard education program is really designed to kind of pump out educators who are attuned to social justice and who work with social justice, justice ethic in mind. And that was problematic because a lot of the values and principles of social justice contradicts Orthodox Mormonism, at least the chapel Mormonism that I was raised with. I know there are liberal progressive Mormons, there continue to be, that reconcile Mormonism with principles of social justice, but that type of Mormonism was not the Mormonism that I knew and practiced. I had been exposed to pretty conservative ideas about Mormonism. And although I probably was more liberal than most Mormons, I was still not like super liberal, at least at in this particular cohort and in this particular program. I think I probably was the resident conservative. And so, for example, this was during the year of Proposition 8, and the church was actively working against homosexual marriage in California, and everyone knew that. And I felt very defensive of the church, but also a little bit confused, because social justice was very attractive in that I felt like it offered a very compelling and beautiful way to look at the world. And on one level, I really couldn't understand why LGBT people should have fewer rights than homosexual people. Like, my conscience told me that this made moral sense. But up until that point, my conscience had never really conflicted with my Mormonism. They always seemed to be aligned. And so this flickering of conscience, I, at the time, took to be moral confusion within myself. And the way I resolved that was to double down on my orthodoxy, to trust that the church had it right, and that there was nothing wrong with me because I had LGBT friends in the program and I honestly loved them. I honestly respected them and wished the best for them. And so I kind of felt like my practice of Mormonism couldn't possibly be damaging to them and or to LGBT people in general. I didn't feel personally hostile to that community. And so I felt like, okay, I can continue to practice Mormonism, and it's not a harmful religion, although my church is doing this thing in California, which I don't understand, but I'm just going to have to put that on the shelf. I think that was the first time I ever had to put something on the shelf. And so I went through that year, and there was just, it wasn't just that one issue. There were so many new ideas that were presented to me so compellingly and had me examining my religion from a new lens of that basically the way I reconciled these ideas of social justice with Mormonism was that I concluded that Jesus, in fact, advocated for social justice, which I continue to believe to this day. I found all sorts of evidence in the scriptures that he was anti-materialist, that he stood with the oppressed, that he had no interest in supporting the oppressor. And so that's kind of the philosophical and theological reconciliation I made in my mind. But nevertheless, there were all these new ideas that I had never taken seriously before. And in fact, when confronted with them, I was outwardly very hostile to them, to the point where one of my professors pulled me aside and said that I was acting and speaking like someone who had never confronted opposition to my beliefs before. And the way this conversation struck me at the time was, wow, this liberal professor is making all sorts of assumptions. She has no idea the opposition that I faced to practice my religion. I basically blew up my nuclear family in order to practice Mormonism. My dad and I lost contact for years over this. And also, I was raised in a very philosophically liberal part of the country. I was raised in Evanston, Illinois, which, if anyone is familiar with Evanston, they know it's very diverse and the teachers are very explicitly liberal in their the way that they articulate classes and concepts. And so I always felt like kind of the conservative outsider in that environment growing up. So this idea that I had never been confronted with ideas that opposed Mormonism felt ridiculous to me at the time. And I felt very she was very condescending and could not understand me. That is how I felt during the conversation at the time. Looking back on that exchange, I think she was absolutely right, because I had never taken ideas that challenged Mormonism seriously before. I think maybe I was too young or immature or too certain. I'm not exactly sure why, but up until that year of grad school, I had never considered the possibility that perhaps my church didn't always get it right and that the prophets didn't always have it 100% correct all the time. So I was reacting in a very hostile, defensive way to these ideas, because I don't think I could have handled the implications of what what if my church occasionally gets it wrong? The idea that my church wasn't true had not yet entered my mind. But the idea that the church might sometimes get it wrong was something that I had an allergic reaction to, and I don't think I reacted very well in school and in that setting. When I graduated from that program, I moved back to Chicago, and I was 26, and I took a job on the South Side teaching reading in high school. But that summer before my job started, I had, for the first time in my life, a full-blown existential crisis, and it felt like it came out of nowhere, although I think it probably had built up in the year before while I was kind of absorbing all these new ideas, but I didn't realize consciously that I was grappling with anything until I actually graduated and returned home and felt all of a sudden like massive amounts of uncertainty and doubt, because I was 26, I was not married, and for the first time in my life, I was contemplating the possibility that I might not actually get married or have children. And up until that point in my life, my certainty about the church had always kind of coalesced with my certainty about my own life trajectory. I felt very certain from my patriarchal blessing and from spiritual experiences that I'd had that my life included marriage and being a mom. And specifically, honestly, I had spiritual experiences that led me to believe my marriage would be very joyful, which it turns out now I have a very joyful marriage. So those feelings actually did come to pass. But when I was 26, I didn't have any of the foreknowledge of what would happen. And I felt like I was facing the possibility for the first time that the things said in my patriarchal blessing would not pan out, and that I might stay single for the rest of my life. And the thought was so devastating that it caused me to wonder whether God existed. And the question that really like drove me at that point in my life was, if God exists and if my church is indeed true, why doesn't it organically manifest itself as truth in my life? In other words, why do I have to synthetically prop up this religious reality constantly through reading the scriptures, through prayer, through temple attendance, through church talks, through church activity? Like, all of these things serve to prop up this religious reality in which I operated, but take those things away and would the church still organically be true? I wasn't sure. And I went through a very dark period where I remember looking out at Lake Michigan and like wondering if God, for the first time in my life, wondering if God existed, and feeling so, so dark and depressed at the thought that maybe he didn't. And so during this time, I also decided to start dating non-members and or people who weren't members of my church, rather. It's a nicer way to say it. And I ended up dating someone in the building in which I was living. And at the time I was having this existential crisis. I was also trying to potty train a Labrador puppy on the 9th floor of a building in a studio apartment. And I was working like 15 hours a day. So I'd work all day. My puppy was crated. And then I would potty train my puppy all night. So I wasn't sleeping. I was in the middle of an existential crisis. I was dating this non-member, and I ended up, about 2 weeks into that relationship, I ended up sleeping with him 3 times in 1 week. And at the end of that week, I realized, like, I kind of came to my senses and I was like, oh my gosh, I just broke temple covenants. And I don't even know if the church is true anymore. I think I'll go one more time to church just as closure, but I don't feel like I can be a Mormon and be actively sleeping with this person I'm dating. Like, these two things don't go together, at least for me. And I have to make a choice. And since I'm in the middle of a crisis, like, I'm not going to choose the church because I don't even know if it's true. So I went to church that Sunday, thinking I would be saying goodbye to it. And what happened was that I had this incredibly powerful spiritual experience. Every single meeting, I felt the spirit. I felt like people were talking directly to my concerns. The sacrament meeting was about doubt. And I had never in my life attended a Mormon sacrament meeting on the subject of doubt ever. And since that day, I never have again. It just seems so weird that the Sunday that I was thinking about leaving, they would address my concerns and my doubts so directly. And so by the end of that 3-hour block, I basically turned myself into the bishop and for church discipline, and broke up with my boyfriend and decided that this was God's message to me, that I needed to be a Mormon, that I needed to stay in the church, that basically I had sinned and needed to repent, and my existential crisis was probably a result of my sins. So I went through the process of church discipline, and within a matter of weeks while I was into that process, I met my now husband. And that, the story of meeting him and dating him and eventually getting married to him, it all felt so miraculous. I could spend a lot of time going into different specific experiences that felt like God talking to me or felt like divine intervention. That by the time we were married, I was fully convinced of the existence of a benevolent God who intervened in my life in miraculous ways and was a very forgiving God. And by extension, I felt ready to fully embrace Mormonism again because I had found God within the Mormon church, within that context. And found my husband in the Mormon church. And so I felt like that was able to resolve a lot of my existential angst. At the same time, even though, you know, I was able to like survive church discipline, which I'll have to do a whole other episode on church discipline and what it meant to me, what I think about it now, but I went through that process, married my husband in the temple, and I never was able to fully recover my certainty. Even though I felt like my marriage was miraculous and the product of a divine intervention of God, it didn't really speak to my concerns about the church specifically. And so from the age of 26 on, I had lingering questions in the back of my mind. And I learned to live with a shelf, and I was putting stuff on the shelf, and my habits and my behavior and my outward practice of the religion were by default completely orthodox. But in the back of my mind, I did have, for the first time in my experience as a Mormon, these questions. And so when I was pregnant with my second child, I got tired of being the one in our marriage who was always the uncertain one, the one who like seemed to have doubt. My husband never had any doubt. He was so faithful and so loyal. And so I decided to fix my testimony. And the way I decided I would do this was read the standard works cover to cover, Old Testament, New Testament, Book of Mormon, DNC, Pearl of Great Price, with the manuals, a scripture journal, and pray over them, and sacrifice my my first daughter's nap time in order to do this. I felt like sacrifice, prayer, and scripture study would heal my doubt, answer my questions, enable me to live as an Orthodox Mormon once again. So, and I longed for that certainty. I really wanted to regain it. So I threw myself into this project and I completed it. It took me hours and, of study every day, but the end result was not what I had hoped. In fact, like very early on, literally as early as the book of Deuteronomy, I started with the Bible. I felt like my shelf was just getting heavier because the Old Testament has so much misogyny and genocide that I had never noticed before. I don't know what I was thinking when I read these texts as a young person, because I had read the Bible cover to cover before, but for some reason the genocide escaped me. This time, reading through, I could not understand how a God that would command genocide was any morally superior to a God that commands the sacrifice of children. Like, both are horrific, but to me, solving the problem of child sacrifice with genocide seemed just as morally degenerate as sacrificing your baby on an altar, if not worse, because the Israelites were, according to the book of Deuteronomy, which I now know to be problematic, but at the time I thought it was, you know, the literal word of God, the Israelites were commanded to leave none alive, to sacrifice man, woman, child, infant, the animals. And I just was floored that I was pregnant with my second child, and I felt the sacredness of that new life growing within me, and I couldn't morally reconcile, like, how this God could be worth my worship. And then the misogynistic Mosaic law, where women are so dehumanized in some of those laws, it made me wonder, does God care about me as a woman? Honestly, I don't remember what I made of DNC 132 at the time. I'm sure it was problematic, but my main issues at that point of my faith journey were with the Old Testament. And I remember talking about it constantly with Abe, my husband. And one night he turned to me and said, "I am afraid you are going to leave the church." And he was really scared. And I responded to him. I said, "Mormonism is who I am. Yes, I know I had like a period of existential insanity before we met, but our marriage resolved that all for me. I am Orthodox to the core. Like, I can't imagine my life without the church in it. And I will never leave it. It is who I am." And that's truly how I felt. I felt Mormon, like, in my bones. So with that conversation, I had kind of a moment of clarity that leaving the church was not an option, because it was so woven into my identity. And whatever questions I had about God or about the Old Testament or about women, about genocide, like, they needed to be shelved because my identity was Mormon. And so I shelved them. 4 years, I shoved them to the back of my mind, actively suppressed them, and reverted to Mormon Orthodox speech and practice. Not that I, you know, had deviated since meeting my husband in terms of practice in any way, but just those habits of mind, and viewing the world through a very Mormon perspective. Like, I just sank back into that as much as I could. But honestly, I mean, again, I still had a shelf that was still there. So I was in active suppression of my questions at that point. It wasn't like that I just had a passive shelf on the back of my mind. It was a matter of, like, actively suppressing the questions that I had. So to speed things up, about 2 years ago, I went on a retreat, a sex therapy retreat that Jennifer Finlayson Fife ran to, like, kind of rehabilitate LDS women, because we have very religious conservative views, a lot of us, towards sex, and it's unhealthy, and I recognize that, and I wanted to get better. So I went to this retreat with a friend who I didn't realize had left the church. I invited her to go with me and she agreed, but then she said, "You know, just so you know, I've left the church, but I'm happy to go to this retreat with you." And so while we were at that retreat in Seattle, we were at dinner and I asked her why she had left the church. And now, as someone who has left the church, I realize this is a very unusual question to be asked. Normally, if you're an Orthodox Mormon, you want to stay as far away from this subject as possible. At least I assume, because most Orthodox members have no questions for me. This is not a topic they seem to want to talk about. But I think because I had a shelf that I was constantly actively suppressing, that made it possible for me to ask this question of my friend. I didn't really feel fear. I should have, probably in retrospect, but I didn't ask that question with any fear. I just was curious and wanted to know. And she told me I was the first person who had asked her in 2 years. And so she spilled her story in extensive and graphic detail and did not censor herself at all in terms of what she had learned about church history. And I don't remember everything she told me. It was so much information. I do remember one point in the conversation excusing myself to go to the bathroom because I was pregnant with my third child at that point and I thought I would pass out. It was so overwhelming to be confronted with all of this church history, which was doubly traumatic because she was telling me things that my dad had shouted about my entire childhood, but that I had dismissed as anti-Mormon lies. Because when I brought some of these concerns to my stake president, in tears at one point because of the things my dad was saying about church history, my stake president basically told me they were opposition from Satan and there was no truth to them. And I listened to my church leader because I believed the church was true. He was the representative of Jesus Christ to me. And I basically turned off my brain to the church history that my dad had been shouting about my whole life. So when my friend started going into graphic detail about all these church history facts that I had just not considered because I thought they were anti-Mormon lies, that's when I felt like I was going to pass out. I felt like my world was actually shattering around me. And, I went to the bathroom. I like leaned against a wall. I might've even have sat down on the floor. I'm not sure, but it was overwhelming. And the one story that stuck with me, cause it was just so much information, but the one story she shared that was a huge like turning point in my mind was a story of Zina Huntington Jacob Smith Young and how many last names she has tells you something about her. She was, must have been a very beautiful woman, Third General Relief Society of the Church, I believe. But when she was a young woman, she was dating a man named Henry Jacobs, and Joseph Smith wanted to take her as a plural wife. And Zina turned him down and married Henry Jacobs instead. And Joseph Smith was actually supposed to seal them or marry them, but he didn't show up. Someone else showed up. And soon after they got married, Joseph Smith sent Henry Jacobs far away on a mission and then courted her once again and convinced her that she was supposed to be his plural wife. So when Henry Jacobs returned from his mission, he discovered that his wife was actually indeed married to Joseph. Joseph allowed Zina to live with Henry Jacobs, even though he claimed her as his own. And she had two kids with Henry Jacobs, but Joseph Smith was martyred not very long after. I don't know the exact time period of all of this, but after he was martyred, Zina, who probably thought she was off the hook, ended up being claimed by Brigham Young as his property that he had inherited from Joseph Smith. And what's so tragic about this is that Zina and her husband appear to have been deeply in love. And he wrote her love letters to the day he died. He missed her. He missed his children that he had with her. But because the prophet had claimed Zina and sent him to California, I think, he was not allowed to be near her. And after Brigham Young died, Zina actually went and cared for Henry Jacobs before he died. And it's just so heartbreaking and tragic. And I couldn't wrap my mind around how Joseph Smith could have been a good person and done this to Zina. And so when I came home, I ended up going on bed rest shortly after that. And I had a lot of time to read. And so I basically decided to address this issue of polygamy head on. And I turned to Brian Hales, who is the church's top apologist in the area of in terms of polygamy. And I hoped that Brian Hales could give me some good reasons for why Joseph Smith would have done this to Zina. What I found out in the course of reading volume one of Brian Hales' volumes on polygamy is that Brian Hales had no good answers for why Joseph Smith did this to Zina, and indeed the problems with polygamy were so much greater than I could have ever imagined. Each wife is tragic and complicated and problematic in her own way. And what I found to be especially abhorrent by the end of that reading that book was that Brian Hales, the church apologist, was constantly making apologies and excuses for why Joseph Smith lied about polygamy to Emma and to the public. He admitted that Joseph Smith lied continually. He's a very responsible in terms of his data, thanks to his top researcher, Don Bradley, who is an excellent Mormon historian. Brian Hales really does have the best data out there. He puts it out in graphs and charts, and he does explain the situation as the situation with polygamy in a way that's pretty real, but also so apologetic. And by the end of that book, I just felt that it was morally wrong to defend Joseph Smith's lies. I just feel like lies are inherently unethical. And the suffering of these women was unethical and tragic. And this opened the possibility in my mind that Joseph Smith made a mistake with polygamy. I wasn't yet at the point where I didn't believe in the Book of Mormon. Or I even still entertain the idea that Joseph Smith was a true prophet, but that he had made a huge mistake with polygamy. And I read Ruffs and Rolling and A House Full of Females, and I tried to, you know, like be responsible and check out the Joseph Smith, some Joseph Smith papers. I don't know exactly which volume, but I flipped through his personal writings and tried to find letters that were written around the time that he was practicing polygamy. And I wanted to see what types of things he was writing to Emma. And I remember reading one letter that basically to me felt very duplicitous and made me feel sick when I read it, because he told Emma that he just didn't like the low company that he found himself surrounded with, and he daydreamed of, you know, going off with her alone. And I looked at the date and knew that he was practicing polygamy, and just felt like, first of all, to talk about your followers who sacrificed so much to follow you as low people seemed very uncharitable. And then to say that he wanted to go off with Emma alone when in fact he was marrying so many women behind her back, it just felt wrong to me. And so my picture of Joseph Smith was permanently altered. I no longer felt good about him, although I still left open the possibility that he was a prophet, but not a prophet that I liked. Then, after doing all this research on polygamy and concluding that it was wrong, that Joseph Smith was fallible, that opened me to this concept of prophetic fallibility, which I had never considered before. I'd had an existential crisis before, the whole church isn't true, but I never zeroed down on prophetic infallibility or fallibility. For whatever reason, that wasn't the issue at the time. But with this whole polygamy rabbit hole, prophetic fallibility came into very clear view. And I started questioning the church's current practices and policies with regards to LGBT people. And up until that point, I have been very outwardly supportive of the church's stance in this regard. And because I didn't really think, I believed that the prophets were speaking for God. But knowing that Joseph Smith made a mistake about polygamy opened me to the idea that maybe they're making a mistake about LGBT people today. And I started to feel a lot more attuned to that issue. And it's a very disturbing and troubling issue. So in that sense, my conscience, I guess, started waking up after a period of deep sleep. And months into this, I don't know at what point, I read the CES letter, which I'll do a whole episode on that because I feel like it deserves an episode on what that means to post-Mormons and what it meant to me. But briefly, the CES letter is an overview of all the challenges that Mormonism faces historically and archaeologically and theologically. And what I recognized in the CES letter is that there's a section in polygamy, and I felt like I had done a lot of research in polygamy, and that everything he wrote about polygamy was not only accurate, but it was only the tip of the iceberg. There's so many problems with polygamy, and he only covers a very few, and he does so with accuracy. So that led me to feel very feel similarly about the other issues which he presents, including the historicity of the Book of Mormon, the character of Joseph Smith, the Kinderhook plates, the Book of Abraham, which I had always kind of known about, but somehow absorbed into my Mormon world and was able to make it work until all of a sudden it became very clear that I could no longer accept the apologetic excuses for that. And I mean, there are just so many issues in the CES letter that he brings up and he basically covers them very briefly. He touches on them all very briefly, but the end result is a picture of the church that is not flattering, and most certainly not true in the sense that we think of the church. So, with the CES letter in mind, I went back to studying these issues more in depth and basically concluded that not only was Joseph Smith wrong about polygamy, but that the church wasn't true. And I feel like this podcast is getting too long, so I'm going to stop there. But I just want to end by saying that I withdrew my records today. I went on to quitmormon.com and I resigned from the church. And I don't even quite know what to make of that right now, or like how I feel. I'm grateful for the chance I had to talk about part of my faith journey, and we'll continue that at some other time. I guess to just record my feelings at the moment, I feel so tired. I've been angry for the last couple days about a lot of things, but right now I feel very tired and just ready to be done with Mormonism. But that's impossible because I live in Orem. My husband, my kids, my mom are all active Mormons. My neighbors, so many of my friends. And so what extracting myself from this religion feels impossible, even though I have officially disaffiliated myself today. I think some part of me feels relief to have that part done. Part of me feels very sad because really I feel sad about the way this reflects that my husband and I aren't as completely united as we have been up until a couple years ago when this faith crisis started. And so I'm sad. I'm sad about that. But I hope to start a new beginning that's, like I said, I think at the beginning of this podcast, a little kinder, a lot less fanatical, and hopefully a lot more wise than I have approached my life up to this point. So thank you so much for listening, and I so appreciate the space to work these things out. So thank you, and we'll see you next time.